Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
It's Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haverstroh.
Tom, it's the Final Four of Top Chef. Cue, like, college students in rugby shirts behind the basket playing weird horned instruments and brass. And this is it. This is the Final Four for one of the craziest, parody, unpredictable, awesome seasons of Top Chef.
Yeah, the Final Four, it feels weird not having Bruce or Chris or Fati here in the Final Four, but that's what's so great about this season is these are all really strong competitors. And you know what? I still don't know who's my super favorite, but man, it is so hard to pick a favorite this season.
Yeah, we did a uniquely terrible job at predicting the outcome of this season. You and I, what we drafted at the very before the first episode, we drafted the field like fantasy basketball or fantasy baseball or fantasy football. And we, I mean, how bad did we do, Tom?
We did super bad. I actually ran the numbers on this. There is a slightly negative correlation to where we picked contestants and how many points they ended up having in the competition. So
basically, if you put a pet turtle on a floor and put like 18 cards with chef's names and just said, go pick to the turtle, it would have done the average turtle would have done better than I.
Yeah, slightly better than what we did, because we were barely above random, and it was in the negative. So the higher we chose them, the fewer points they got, which is embarrassing, Kevin. It's embarrassing. So we watched one episode, and I felt pretty good.
Oh, we did watch one episode, right? We did watch one episode. I mean, that's how bad we were. I'm never going to make fun of an NBA general manager ever again.
So to remind people, we drafted 1 through 18, and that included the Last Chance Kitchen, folks. And we drafted Tyler first. Then 2, Fatih, Bruce, Claudette, and then we get someone who made it to the Final Four, Joe Flan. That's crazy.
It's very funny. In my episode 1 notes, I have a little parenthesis by Joe Flan as non-mustache.
Yes.
Because we will be having Joe Sasto, the Joe with a mustache, on very briefly. We're going to be speaking to him shortly, so hang in.
Yes, stay tuned for that. And then we drafted Chris, then Joe Sasto, Rogelio Tanya, Brother Luck, Adrian, another finalist, Kwame, Laura, Leanne, and then Carrie at 16 out of 18 picks. I don't know who the equivalent is of Carrie. We should have discussed this before the show, but Carrie makes it to the Final Four, and she was the third to last pick. We picked a couple.
She's like Isaiah Thomas at number 60.
That's exactly right. Isaiah Thomas.
Manu was like a second round pick. I mean, obviously you can go through Draymond, Carlos Boozer. There have been some very productive second round picks. Who've turned out to have wonderful careers. But let's get to the show. This was the Final Four. They're now, this is Colorado. And so, rightly so, Rocky Mountain Oysters, which another one I've been waiting for the marijuana challenge, which hasn't materialized. And I've been waiting for the Rocky Mountain Oyster Challenge or the game meet. Well, they did a little game meet. And so basically the chefs, the quick fire is Rocky Mountain Oysters two ways. Pretty cut and dry in that respect. Rocky Mountain Oysters, for those who do not know, are the testicles of the oxen. Am I correct there?
Is an oxen a cow? Yes, right? Or is a cow an oxen?
I just like saying oxen. It reminds me of like Bible class growing up in like an Orthodox Jewish day school. It was like oxen is how they referred to the cow.
They're bull testicles. They're bull nuts. And man, did they have fun with the nut puns on this one. It was great.
And they all did them two ways. And to form, each of the chefs chose fried Rocky Mountain oysters, which is kind of a no-brainer as one of the ways. And then they kind of just went to work. Carrie decided she'd do a pâté, which I thought was very ballsy.
Nice.
Joe Sasto was going to braise his second pear or second serving in brown butter. Did a little nice little radish garnish up top. Adrian does a dashi, which was so exciting to me because I've become, as you know, I am, though she is not represented on Team Kevin in the fantasy draft, I have adopted Adrian. I probably should have traded for her given my level of enthusiasm. But she goes with a dashi, which is kind of brilliant because like dashi is traditionally made with kelp and bonito flakes. It's a very, you know, very clean Japanese broth, right? And so she does it with those traditional components, and then she adds Lao Gan Ma, which is a Chinese condiment, which is kind of it's got a little picture of a Chinese grandma, and you see it in the Asian grocery stores where I do occasional grocery shopping, and it's like a Chinese grandma on the portrait on the thing, and it's basically a chili sauce. It is a Chinese chili sauce. And in fact, she presents it, and Padma says very clever. So she somehow creates a dashi sauce out of Rocky Mountain oysters. I'm swooning in admiration because I just have loved watching Adrian's trajectory. And then Joe Flam comes in with a puree over white bean and tomato sauce. And actually, Joe Sasto and Joe Flam essentially made very similar
same dishes. Same dishes. They're twins. They're basically twins. And I thought Adrian, it was one of those things. Adrian made her dish where I was like, there's definitely more than a half hour on the clock. Like, there's no way Adrian's dish could have come out in 30 minutes. It's crazy.
We've been told by our best intel these chefs actually do that. This is, to me, in some ways, quick fires to me are even more impressive than the regulation elimination tournament, just because of the constraints of time. They don't really know what's happening until like right before. Like, as an amateur home chef, I'm thinking about like a meal 3 days in advance. Like, I treat it like the finale every time. And their ability just to kind of turn and just turn these dishes in like half an hour, which takes, is about the amount of time I need to peel an onion, basically.
And we're going to have Joe Stash on the show later this episode. And I'm going to definitely ask him, was he surprised at how long it took him to win his first quickfire challenge? Because this episode, congratulations, Joe, you finally got your first quickfire. I thought it was an upset over Adrian.
Yeah, no, it was a nice little, he did a cornflake breading on the Rocky Mountain oyster, does a white bean puree. It was actually very funny because there's this moment where I was like, hey, Joe, what are you doing? You know, and they're kind of, basically the show has to create narrative while these chefs are cooking, which isn't kind of fundamentally exciting television. So they always tape the conversations like, what are you making? I'm making, you know, and he said, you know, over a white bean puree. And then Joe non-mustache, Joe Flam, says, me too. And I actually thought it was a joke, but indeed they both did the exact same dish. Adrian came in second. We can only discern because there were two unfavorites and two favorites. And Adrian's dashi came in second, but I'm just kind of so utterly impressed with it. And then Carrie had some vegetables to kind of lighten it up, but the pate was kind of livery. And Joe Flam decided not to cook his Rocky Mountain oyster before he fried it. And I think the deal is you kind of want to maybe, but I don't know how to ask Joe, but like, you'd want to like boil it in salt water just to kind of soften it up and then fry it, probably, is my guess. But you don't have a hell of a lot of time because it's quick fire.
I don't like the texture of a really tough Rocky Mountain oyster. Like, here's my thing about Rocky Mountain oysters. I feel like everyone just fries the shit out of it because they don't like the taste. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think basically there's an understanding if you're going to eat weird food that, like, if you just you can deep fry anything, like the tarantula, I think from earlier in the season or last season, I can't even remember. But if you have a weird food, if you can basically deep fry just about anything and enjoy it. Where are you on organ meats in general and, like, offal and all those things?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good on organ meats, as in, like, I totally dig it. I'm in on hearts, tripe. What other interesting ones? Like, I do, like Joe Sasto mentioned, sweetbreads. Like, I'm good with that. But the Rocky Mountain oysters, I had them at Soul Gastro Lounge here in Charlotte, which is a really top pick here in Charlotte. If you're on the road, check out Soul Gastro Lounge in Plaza Midwood, right around the corner from where I live. They have Rocky Mountain oysters, and they fry the shit out of them, too. And it just occurred to me is, like, what food has the highest fry rate?
I
think
question.
Rocky Mountain oysters is up there, right?
I mean, what do we basically eat fried that we eat no other way? I'm trying to think. Like, I think it's got to be Rocky Mountain oysters.
It's up there. So I don't know if that's a testament to the texture of it. And man, did I cringe. I don't know about you, Kevin, but I cringed when Carrie put the testicles through the grinder.
Yeah, that was a visual I did not need on a Thursday night. But Carrie ground her Rocky Mountain oysters to kind of create the pate, which was just a visual that was very aggressive. And it kind of unnecessary. So Sasto comes out of there, and it's interesting that kind of the takeaway was, and it was a very interesting setup, and I don't know if you noticed this, but like, so Sasto with some bravado kind of suggested, hey, Adrian's right behind me, kind of declared himself the favorite going into the final turn, which I can't really contest. I mean, I think you and I have been saying for the better part of 6 weeks or so that he's sort of emerged as the kind of the morning odds, the morning line favorite, kind of headed toward the finale, but kind of declared, you know, that Adrian was kind of right behind him. Are we seeing some separation here coming out of that quick fire? And as I said, the kind of the technical chefs of Joe Sasto and Adrian kind of nudging ahead.
Yeah, I think you got to say that Joe Sasto is the favorite because I think based on pure points, he is the favorite. Coming into this episode, he had 86 points and Carrie was right behind him at 84 points under our system, which rewards quick fire wins, elimination challenges and debits. If you don't finish in the top or if you finish in the bottom three, you're going to be debited some points. So Joe Sasto and Carrie were two front runners, head and shoulders above the rest. And Joe Flam, you know, he was out of the competition. He came quickly back in. So I don't think it's too aggressive to say Joe Sastre was in the lead. But to say that Adrian was coming for me as if Carey wasn't there, I think we felt all season long that I don't think Joe Sastre really sees Carey as an equal just by his commentary. We can ask him about that.
Even through a little shade of she's not going to put him on toast. But do we know if quick – because one of the things I'm starting to believe, and even going back to kind of Shirley, is quick fire success an indicator for long-term success in the show?
Yeah, because Carey is a quick fire juggernaut. But I'd be curious to see if quick fires heading into the final four or the final three, if that's predictive. And certainly in this season, we've come to learn is that it's not predictive because Joe Sasto's still around and Carey's not.
You and I think, are both hard-bitten realists, but we're both softies at heart. And it's always nice to see the family. So now after the quick fire, the chefs are you walk into their secondary house in Are they in Breckenridge? Where are they?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. And they don't. I don't think they even knew.
Actually, yeah. I don't even know where they are. But and then family members are there. So Joe Sasto's father, Adrian's mother, Carey's mother, and Joe Flam's grandmother, whom he, you know, kind of grew up at the feet, kind of making on the south side of Chicago the Italian dishes of his childhood that inspired him to cook. And then they walk in and dinner is then served by those kind of iconic family dishes are served by the family members to the young chefs. It's a touching sequence. Any takeaways from there?
Yeah. What was your favorite dish that they presented? Like, which one did you see that you're like, ooh, I really want some of that?
So gumbo is sort of a thing for me. So I was very taken aback by the gumbo because it's something it was one of the first kind of complicated dishes I started cooking. And I'm not a huge pasta person. The beef stroganoff sort of a level of intrigue. It is a brand of sort of middle American Gentile cooking that I just have never been exposed to. I don't know that I've ever eaten beef stroganoff. And
my mom made me beef stroganoff, but it was very much like a hamburger helper with sour cream
I think an NBA press room is probably the first time I've encountered beef stroganoff in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, the pig's feet was interesting. And the fact that they eat that, the Sastos ate that for Thanksgiving and Christmas every year, the pig's feet, that was fascinating to me.
Well, you braise them, and I mean, I think the meat gets pretty tender, and it does. I mean, that was sort of the basis of the gravy. So the challenge is now presented. Use one of the iconic dishes as the basis for your challenge, and that's going to be the elimination challenge. Joe Sasto, by virtue of winning with his corn flake breaded wacky oysters, gets 30 extra minutes. So now the other chefs only have an hour and a half, whereas Joe has 2 hours. And what's very interesting is you see – I immediately identified Adrian because she's got gumbo. And my first thought is, watch out. This is a trap.
Yep.
That's barely enough time to do a roux, much less do a gumbo, which is so dependent on just having things kind of sit and stew and just it absorbs the juices. I mean, gumbo needs time. Like when I make a gumbo, and again, I'm just a shitty home chef. Like I do mine 2 days in advance, and I want the shrimp and everything to sit in the whole substance. And so I'm saying this is not going to end well for Adrian. She's going to try to do a gumbo in 90 minutes, and it's not going to work. And that is my big fear. Whereas, hey, Joe Flam, he's at home. This guy makes pasta in his sleep. Joe Sasto, pasta in his sleep. Beef stroganoff, a relatively, I think, easy dish to appropriate and elevate. And I'm worried about Adrian. And that was sort of, I even had made a note, Adrian might be toast.
Yeah, and I was feeling the same thing. And I think she was sweating it too. But man, she came up with an amazing rendition of the gumbo, which she just pre-cooked everything perfectly and didn't go for the traditional gumbo. And that was – if you're going to elevate a dish, when that came out, I was stunned. I was like, not only did she pull off a gumbo in basically an hour and a half – but she did it where it was not a gumbo, but it had the theme of a gumbo, and it just looked so good, and she nailed it.
It was Top Chef competition at its best, which is there's a trap here, and it seems unavoidable. How do I work myself out of this? So she does her roux as fast as she can. She uses duck fat, which is wonderful because I keep a tub of duck fat that my butcher sells from some Hudson Valley duck farm. It's like a big white plastic tub of goo, and it's my favorite fat to work with. And so she does that roux with duck fat the way her mother does. But then she butter poaches the crab with miso Tabasco butter, which is just like, I mean, an amazing flavor profile there. She sears the wild shrimp. She gets 2 pounds of the Whole Foods. I mean, just rather than just kind of dump everything in a pot, she's going to deconstruct the gumbo. She does the proteins beautifully, butter poaching the crab, searing the shrimp. She does a pipe of rice that she just kind of assembles in the carved out crab leg shell. She does the andouille chips because, hey, you know, the sausage isn't really going to suck up it. I mean, the sausage isn't going to perform its function of kind of sitting in there and really, you know, kind of just infusing the stew. So she decides to do them as a chip, and it's gorgeous. And judging from the judge's comments, it's also damn tasty. I think Tom says it's seasoned to perfection. One more grain of salt might have been too much. One less might have been not enough. So it's beautiful because it's a triumph of seasoning from a chef who was challenged by seasoning at the beginning of the competition. So we're seeing that trajectory. I am a sucker for Adrienne's arc. She's become one of my favorite kind of underdog chefs in recent seasons. I am so pulling for her, though I like everybody in the competition. And she wins with this. And she is the only non-pasta dish of the four. What did you think? The other three did very well, right?
I know. They all just crushed it. And I think that's the theme of this season, is that they're all coming in playing their best game in the finals here. And they're just juggernauts. I felt bad for everyone here because I can't imagine there's a worse I don't know if there's a worse feeling of going home on Top Chef for an A- dish, you know, even an A dish. I think these are all A dishes. And the thing was that Adrienne, Joe Sasto and Joe Flam had A+ dishes, and Carrie came with an A.
Adrienne has an A+. The Joes have an A, and it sounds like Carrie had kind of an A-. Joe Sasto does these really lovely rotellis, which, you know, you know the little wagon wheel pastas that you get like in the crappy macaron. So but he does an entirely, you know, he does these spirals that are gorgeous with mushrooms and chard, and the pig feet gravy's kind of rolled up, and it's
I wanted to eat that so badly. That one looks so good.
His pastas are so just aesthetically gorgeous that, like, I'm going to tell him. I'm excited. I made a reservation at his place for a couple weeks from now, and I can't wait to dig into his food because it's just, and really just to get a look at it. He just is such a beautiful aesthetic chef. Flam, as he says, look, when you're doing basic cooking, there's nothing to hide behind. He basically is just going to take his meatballs and rigatoni, his grandmother's meatballs and rigatoni, which have been in the family for generations. He juices the tomatoes. He makes his concentrated pomodoro paste, and then he grounds up bacon with pork and veal, and he makes an anelotti out of it with like Parmesan crisps, which were his only ding, apparently, some basil, and give it up to Carrie, who decides, hey, you know what? I'm going to make these big raviolo with beef stroganoff in the middle. And she uses buffalo meat to sort of pay homage to her mountain roots and her father's love of game meat. She does a buffalo sausage with these mushrooms, and she herb creme fraiche, caramelizes onions, and she got this lovely egg yolk that kind of runs over the whole thing. And then her one error, which apparently is kind of the basis for sending her home, in no shame, was that she didn't really the whole point of the stroganoff, and you tell me, is it's like that kind of cream of beef gravy that sort of and she didn't ever reserve that beef kind of runoff that she should have combined with the creme fraiche to create that goopy, lovely cream of meat sort of sauce that beef stroganoff is sort of known by.
That dish could have won any of the previous 11 episodes for the Elimination Challenge. And that's just – but that's where we are. They're just performing at – the margin of error at this point is super slim. And you got to give it to Carrie. I mean, she has – again, we picked two people in Last Chance Kitchen before we selected her in the draft of our season here. And episode two, she came in with the, remember the cheese farm? She won that episode with a potato and ricotta dumpling, butter sauce and hazelnut relish. She always brings in this almost like sweet, kind of desserty ingredient, and it works. In episode seven with the quick fire with the eggs benedict with Nutella and strawberry habanero jam and hollandaise. Episode nine, she did the famous fancy toast with lavender, fig, and goat cheese with candied pecans. And then she won with Chris with the pork green chili poutine. And then episode 11, she won another quick fire challenge with the French onion soup. Fancy toast.
And I mean, it also had like other lovely little touches, like that blueberry and shishito, which was like, she, you know, it's funny because she kind of a homespun chef, but there's always really just really interesting and challenging kind of flavor intersections. And I have immense respect, just a wonderfully a quirky chef who has confidence in her game. And then that was, despite, as she said, I didn't come with the pedigree. And then she goes out on a strong dish, which is nice to see.
Finishes with 78 points on our fantasy scoring. Joe Sasto is at 91. Adrian's at 46. A huge split from the top two guys.
But how's Adrian in the last few weeks?
Crushing. She has 42 points in the last 3 weeks, and Joe Sasto is just ahead of her with 48 points. And, you know, obviously, Joe Flam coming in from Last Chance Kitchen, he only has 8 points. So she is – over the last few weeks, it's hard to pick a favorite between her and Joe Sasso just based on the last few weeks.
Hey, Tom, the chefs did wine mongs back in the judges' chamber or whatever, the holding tank or wherever they go when the judges schmooze. Have you ever – you were in a fraternity. Have you ever done a wine mong?
Yeah, I've done a wine bong before.
Really?
I've also done what's called a slap the bag, which is you take a Franzia bag and you chug from the Franzia bag. And then once you're done, it's almost like a wine bong. Once you're done, you slap the bag. It's the most idiotic thing. It's the most fratty thing. There's absolutely no thought, no cleverness. It is just the dumbest thing. And we did it during an event, a party called Tour de Franzia. So we all dressed up as cyclists and then just partied with Franzia bags.
God, I missed so much of college going to like a study squad. I mean, we took acid and took the number one train at rush hour on a Friday once in New York City, but like we never did that. I mean, so.
Yes. Yeah. So the Tour de Franzia. And you know what? We're going to bring on a fraternity brother himself, Joe Sasto. You have a few last thoughts before we bring him on?
No, let's go to Joe Sasto. Let's not keep him waiting. So, Joe, where do we find you today?
You find me today overlooking Mirror Lake up in Lake Placid, New York City. It's quite nice.
Yeah, I saw on your Instagram story that you were bobsledding.
Yeah, we did a little bobsledding today. I'm pretty much ready for the Olympics now. My girlfriend and I, we're like Olympic athletes at this point.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal, ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like,
yeah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What is bobsledding just like a roller coaster? What is that? Like, is it a rush? Is it
exactly
scary?
Like a roller coaster. I would say it's right on the edge there. There's no like track or anything. So, I mean, you actually get the sensation that at any moment you could flip over and be riding down the chute on the side. And then the crazy part was on that track, we had done like a half mile track and it took us about like, 48 seconds. The guys in the Olympics do a mile and a half at about 52 seconds. And it felt like we were flying. I couldn't imagine going any faster. Like you were just pulling G's, your head, your neck was like tucked down into your chin on every corner. And then the guys that are doing that professionally are doing it like twice as fast. It was crazy.
So are you good with roller coasters? Because I know you're not good with basketball.
No, roller coasters I can handle. The sports and balls that aren't really my thing.
So Kevin, I went to Calmare or Calmare?
No, Calmare. That's right.
All right. Calmare. It's Joe Sasso is the executive chef at Calmare. I went there at All-Star Weekend. I think it was a Friday night. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go pull up on the bar, which is a favorite move of Kevin's, is just to go solo to the bar at a nice restaurant. It had a great bar setting. I could watch you like a creep and totally just scout you from afar. You had no idea I was showing up. And I sat next to a friend of the restaurant, Bruno, and he gave me a nice little conversation about Michael Mina, because Calamari is a Michael Mina restaurant. And it was a wonderful meal. I had the Agnolotti. I had the pizza that you prepared for me. I kept getting food. It was one of those things where I was being very polite. Joe, when you came out and you're like, are you hungry? You want to eat? And I'm like, yeah, I'm totally hungry. But inside I was actually like super full. And you come out with the most like decadent pizza I've ever seen, which was, can you describe that one for me?
Yeah, you definitely had me fooled, because if you're anything like me, like when I go out to you, my girlfriend and I, we just like, we can't stop. We kind of have a problem where we'll go to like one or two dinners a night if we're like out in a town we're not normally at. So when I asked if you're hungry and you're like, oh yeah, totally. I was like, sweet. I can feed this guy as much food as I want right now. But that pizza is a really awesome one we do at the restaurant. And there's a carbonara pizza. So it's like kind of like a white sauce base, kind of like a, I don't know, Mornay or Alfredo sauce, for lack of a better word, like roasted garlic, white sauce on the bottom, gets like thinly shaved potatoes on top, some slices of guanciale, roasted garlic, and then cooked off. And then the real like piece de resistance of the whole thing, is the egg. So like, you know, everybody does egg on pizza, right? I mean, you've had the egg on the pizza, and I don't know how you guys feel about it. But personally, I think it's like one of the biggest, you know, like sins to put on pizza is like that egg. You crack the egg in the center and then it's like it just sits in the center. Everybody fights over it. It's no fun. Like one person gets the yolk and then it just kind of makes the whole center of the pizza really soggy. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And it falls off. Like it falls off the slice.
Yeah. It's awful. Everybody fights over it. And like in theory, it's like, oh, egg on pizza. That sounds awesome. You put an egg on it. It's great. But so like my solution to that at the restaurant was making, essentially like the carbonara mix on the side. So we take like a soft poached 63 degree egg, a mix of like a little bit of the warm pasta water, some cheeses, grated cheese, black pepper, and that gets stirred together table side, emulsified into a sauce. And then we spoon that all over the pizza with the black truffles.
Oh, see, that's smart. You're accounting for chemistry.
Oh yeah. He was very much accounting for chemistry and the actual person. He came out to the bar and made this and whipped up this 63 degree egg for me. It was amazing. And that was after two pasta dishes, and it was the pumpkin ravioli with sea urchin. I mean, Kevin, come on. Think about it. He made basically an Alfredo sauce pizza with an egg on it after a shrimp agnolotti with a pumpkin ravioli. And it was so delicious, so rich. I thought I was going to pass out there at the bar, which is a great sign of a wonderful meal.
Yeah, actually, Joe, I will be in the night of Tuesday, March 6th with my partner and a couple of people. So I'm very excited. The minute I was like, yeah, I got to make my reservation. Hey, let me ask you a question. I'm excited too. One of the interesting things is, you know, thinking about Michael Mina is there's so many different ways a young chef can go, right? Like, do you want to be a guy like Michael who has like, hey, I've got like 30 restaurants to my name. Like, yep. If the Four Seasons is opening in Dubai, that's going to be my place. Or, I mean, you can do it the way Ludo does it. You can do it with the way Craig Thornton does it, which is, hey, I'm going to cook for 40 people a weekend in my house, and to hell with being a restaurateur, because who needs that bullshit in my life? Like, do you know yet? Do you know yet where you want to, like, what is the 49-year-old Joe Sasto's sort of bio page look like? I mean, do you have aspirations, or, hey, I just want to be as good a cook right now or chef right now as I can, and, hey, let the chips fall where they may? Like, do you know where you're doing, like, how you're going to pursue that yet?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely something I've thought a lot about at this point, and now it's just a matter of, you know, the cards falling into the right place. I would say definitely not the Michael Mina route. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a big corporation like that and doing, you know, a new restaurant in every hotel that opens. And, you know, there's something to be said about, being that smart of a businessman to be able to pull that off. like that is no easy feat to operate and manage and constantly be opening a new restaurant, a new concept. And that takes a whole separate set of skills. But personally, myself, is I'm much more find happiness. And I think my passion lying is something more like along the lines of what Ludo did. And for opening something, whether it be in a strip mall or somewhere in L.A., and focusing in on one smaller restaurant, expanding into maybe a separate concept next door, a separate concept in the back, kind of all grouping them together with a similar theme and idea. All of it's still kind of in the works right now, but I very much have a clear idea of what I want it to be and what I want it to become.
Kevin, I don't think you know this, but Joe, when we sat down and talked the other night, he revealed that he had never really had any intentions of being on Top Chef. He had actually like was unaware of the invites and was kind of like, oh, like maybe I'll do this. Whereas you had that contrast to Chris, who's been like his whole life has been trying to get on to Top Chef. He tried 5 times. And Joe, it wasn't like something he was dead set on. Joe, can you elaborate a little bit more on your road to getting onto Top Chef there?
Yeah, I mean, it was the thing, kind of thing where I was in San Francisco and, you know, a big chunk of my career was spent at Quince. It was like 3 Michelin starred, like shooting for the gold, just like the crazy, you know, high intensity, high pressure situations, working in one of those, like the most stressful kitchen you could imagine. And it was kind of like ingrained in me, you know, the idea of like a television personality chef and shows like that were more about the drama and less about the cooking. And since I had never really even seen the show, that was the mindset that I had. Little did I know that it was like, you know, quite the opposite, actually, where it was very much about the cooking, very little bit about the drama. We had very little to any drama. I think you guys have been watching, you know, the whole season. There was, you know, a couple of those moments that peaked at the judges' table. But for the most part, I mean, it was really, really about the cooking and really about the competition and the chefs and the incredible amount of talent we had there. So going into the show, I had no idea what to expect. It was something I didn't really have my sights set on. But, you know, everything, I'm one of those people that believe that everything happens for a reason. And between the job offer to move down to LA and start this new project and then the opportunity to go on Top Chef, my girlfriend was the one that she just kind of like pushed me in that direction. Was like, you know, don't be a dummy. You have the chance to go do the show. Like, why would you not want to go do this? And then, you know, next thing I knew, I'm flying to Denver.
That's crazy. And you are, I mean, I think people realize that you were truly like sequestered for 3 months. I mean, you are pretty much cut off from civilization when you're on that show.
I don't think people realize it when they like, I like meet people now and, you know, see people and huge fans of the show. I don't think they realize like how serious of a competition they make this and they take this.
Yeah, your girlfriend works at your restaurant there, so that must have been pretty hard to like live basically 24/7 with your girlfriend at the restaurant and then just cut it off completely and just go off to Denver.
Yeah, well, we had a plan for that because we had moved down to LA. We had been living in LA for about 5 days before I left for Denver, which was crazy. So she just moved to this brand new city. Didn't necessarily like have a whole bunch of friends or anything, but the whole idea was that we knew we wanted to get like adopt a pet. So we got a kitten like the very first day we moved down there, next day we moved down there. So she was able to take care of the kitten the whole time while I was gone. And that was like the replacement for me. That took like all her attention and love and energy, which was great. It was like a slight distraction, I suppose, for her, which was in the best way possible.
How subjective do you think judging food is? I mean, it just dawns on me. I mean, food is just one of those things. I mean, I think we know what an objectively good dish looks like and what an objectively like terrible dish is. But I wonder if like, you know, one thing I always think about when the judges are going around tasting 8 things is, are the middle 6 things, when you take away kind of the top dish and the bottom dish, are they just all, do we place too much credence in that? Like, it is, to what extent is it subjective and to what extent is it objective?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think it really depends on what you're judging. I mean, they do a really good job at trying to set the criteria. And then we, as the competitors and chefs, became very good at asking the right questions and being like, so, you know, trying to dial into exactly what they're looking for when it came to judging, whether it be like, what exactly the challenge was, what exactly they would be judging us on, which helped us, you know, cook to a much more subjective or objective rather kind of judge. But I still like that as soon as you said subjective, the first thing I thought of was when Chef Kinch said that my Canederli was pedestrian. And I still like, which, I can't, by the way, get over
that. I imagine for someone like you is just like the worst fucking insult you can possibly get.
The worst.
The worst.
Absolute worst.
Pedestrian. I mean,
I still like, that's something I feel like will always, like, I like to believe that he couldn't think of the right word and pedestrian was not the word he was looking for. But when he said it, I was like, because I was I thought that was going to be my first quick fire win, to be honest.
And then he gets fucking gutted.
And then here I am on the bottom cooking for elimination.
Did you, sorry, go ahead, Kevin. Did you, I mean, congratulations on your first quick fire, first and foremost. I mean, congratulations. It took you this long. What's the deal? You felt like, you're not a quickfire guy. The first episode that we had a Top Chef on, it was Tyler, and he's like, fuck quickfires. I hate quickfires, the worst. And that was actually prophetic because he was eliminated pretty quickly right after he said that. But do you feel like you just didn't get a fair shake on quickfires, or you're not, that's not your best thing and you're more of an elimination challenge? I'm thinking of LeBron James, who just coasts for the regular season and then just pours it on in the playoffs, and he's a real playoff performer.
Well, unfortunately, I don't get that analogy at all. I know LeBron James played basketball, but I don't know at all.
I'm just saying, you live for the elimination challenges, the real main event, rather than the quickfire.
You know, I like to think of myself as one of those cooks or chefs that like thinks really fast on their feet, that loves like that quickfire kind of challenge. Like the whole idea, like when I did Chopped, like I thought that was like a blast because it was pretty much like three rounds of quick fires. But then quick fires here, I had a really hard time dealing with whatever the challenge was. And it wasn't necessarily cooking quickly and thinking quickly. It was like the, whatever it was that they gave us that I just couldn't wrap my head around in that short amount of time. Like deconstruct and recreate a Denver omelet. I was like, because even like going into it, I knew there would be a Denver omelet challenge at some point. And there was something always on my mind, but I just never came up with a better version of a Denver omelet, I guess.
I'm going to stop you there because I want to ask, I forgot about this. Why did everyone forget how to make an omelet that episode?
Oh my God. That was the most painful thing to watch those three. Like, and I think, you know what it was? It's because they gave them like 15 or 20 minutes to make an omelet. So I think that alone was like part of the like mental mind fuck that like eliminate, like quick fire elimination, because you don't need that much time.
Right.
So that like threw them all off. They all start like chopping up vegetables and coming up with like four or five other components they could put with their French omelet. And like at the end of the day, they just completely forgot what the challenge was. Just make a simple, perfect French omelet.
Yeah, that was incredible. Let's get into this past episode and just the Top Chef stuff this last few weeks. Adrian, you said it. Adrian's coming for me. Kevin has a thing for Adrian. I feel like Adrian might be your long lost daughter, Kevin, just by how effusive you are when you talk about her.
Adrian, yeah, I'm at this point, about you it. Can't. Because Joe, like, I think she showed up lacking a certain degree of confidence and, you know, had this seasoning issue. And I love, as a writer, I'm looking for the narrative. And she seems like somebody who's just a decidedly, like, different chef. In the final 3 weeks than she was at the very beginning of the season. And I just like a good story about someone kind of finding themselves in the kitchen. And it's not that you haven't or Flam hasn't or anybody else, but I just think that Adrian is sort of like she bought into her skills at a certain point and kind of blossomed. And as the sports writer kind of looking for the story, like that to me is, that's why I'm kind of in, I have a little chef crush on Adrian. Yeah.
I mean, Adrian, what I saw Adrian, I think her and I bonded in the sense that we both came into this competition with the same, I don't want to say the same like difficulties. where we both had worked. We both had really like outstanding pedigrees and worked for some really incredible chefs. But neither one of us had really at that point in their career been like the executive chef of a restaurant, like, or been like the one making the final calls about the food or just really cooking food that was ours. We were like able to take an idea that one of the other chefs or someone we were working for gave us and create the best possible version of that. And we were both like crushing it in that respect. And then getting to the show and no one giving you that idea to come up with and just saying, okay, cook your version of this, cook your idea. And I think we both kind of stumbled a bit, never having been in that situation before. And it took us both a while to realize like what mattered to us when it came to food. What did we want to be when we put food on the plate? Like, how did we best express our voice? And I think as we each figured that out, we each progressively got better and better and better.
Are Rocky Mountain oysters good?
They're like sweetbreads. If anyone, yeah. Like, they're almost identical to sweetbreads. So, like, if you don't think of them as like bull's testicles, and more like, you know, a sweetbread, which in itself isn't really even that appetizing, but much more familiar, I think, to everyone. They're not bad.
Yeah, you did the cornflake Rocky Mountain oyster, which was really impressive. Also, because you had the added pressure of Joe Flam doing the same exact dish. Did you peek over your shoulder at Joe Flam at any point, being like, "Okay, he's doing it, and it's really, really good. I'm screwed."
Well, the thing was, and especially in that situation, we didn't get the chance to really try each other's food. Just, you know, sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't after each of the challenges. And that was one of the ones where I didn't get to try everyone else's food. I just got to hear what they made. And I was really nervous. I was like, oh shit. Like, Adrian's idea sounded awesome. Like, oh fuck. How did Joe end up with the same idea as me again for like the eighth time this season?
Did you,
I was like, oh, that was smarter Carrie to turn it into a pate. Like, oh man, once again, Carrie with the dark horse, crazy idea.
Do you think we make too much? It's a theme I've sort of latched onto a little bit. And it's one of the things I love about the show is that everybody comes from different backgrounds and is formed by different upbringings and traditions, culturally, aesthetically, and otherwise. You know, the idea of kind of technical chefs with a certain degree of pedigree and kind of the homespun, I don't want to say homespun, but you know, chefs who might cook more intuitively. And by the way, I think the same is true for novelists. I think the same is true for basketball players who have no interest of yours, obviously. But like, you know, is that a distinction in the kitchen that as an analyst, one might make too much of?
I would definitely think it's something people can easily overweigh and place too much value on the difference, and that there may be some, you know, contrast or a big degree of separation. But what I've realized from this show is that, like, this competition in particular really levels that entire playing field. Like, it doesn't matter what your pedigree is or what, you know, who you worked for or who you didn't work for. You know, the way this is all designed really does a great job at really leveling that playing field every single week, no matter who won or who lost the week before.
Was Carrie, was the respect gained throughout the season? Did you have super respect for her in the beginning and she just confirmed that? It seemed like they played it up, Bravo did, the editing team played it up that you, like, downplaying her, throwing her shade throughout the season, like, fucking fancy toast, what's going on here?
I mean, honestly, I had respect for Carrie the whole time. I mean, everybody there that was on the show, they definitely played that aspect of it up. But at the same time, fucking fancy toast, three different. I think she won like $25,000 off the toast through that whole time. I mean, like, no. So, I mean, but then you look at it, it's like when you're doing something just like toast. I mean, it has to be really fucking good. Like in the saloon when we were doing one of those final challenges, that was like another time where Joe Flam was the one who got to try the last bite of all the food. He tried mine. He was like, oh shit, that's great. And then that's when I like leaned over to him and I was like, she can't win again with like a tartine. And then he took the last bite of hers and they didn't show it. He leaned back over to me and he's like, sorry dude, you lost. That's really good. So, like, even so, something to be said about making toast and being able to do it that well, that many different ways. I mean, you know, she has her own, like, set of talents. She's really, really incredible. You know, it's something that it definitely played up with the shade being thrown. But, you know, over the course of the whole season, I gained a ton of respect for her.
Kevin, the saloon episode, you remember that Joe Flam, we discussed it on the show, that Joe Flam got the advantage of being able to steal an ingredient from the rest of the chefs. And I asked Sasto, I was like, do you think it was on purpose that he stole the carrot from Joe? And Sasto, what was your answer?
I was like, absolutely. I think at one point he even told me, he's like, there's no way I'm letting Joe have carrots again, because he saw one of the carrots last. I was actually planning on doing a whole thing with carrots and sarsaparilla. So then it says, like, exactly what I did when I saw the fish. I was like, well, I don't want to have to try to cook chicken or pork chop in the middle of the street. Last thing I want to do is let Adrian get fish, because I know how, you know, confident and successful she's become with cooking fish. So there's definitely strategy involved in everything. There's strategy involved in picking the teams, you know, who you put with who. The, like when Carrie had the Super Bowl challenge, was it the tailgating challenge?
Yep.
And she like purposely put Adrian and I together because we were the one that had been on the bottom the past 2 or 3 weeks. You know, there's strategy in everything that's done in this whole show. To say there's not is turning a blind eye.
Joe, carrots are having a moment. Like, I've just been, and I don't know if, like, I've been having a lot of fun this winter with those tricolor carrots you see at, like, the Hollywood Farmers Market on Sunday. And I've been doing it with, like, I roast the shit out of them with, like this tahini sauce that I got from, which was it, the Jelena cookbook? I forget which one. But, like, radishes are also having a moment. Like, what's having a moment right now among, you know, because it's always something, right? Like, we went through fava beans a couple of years ago. I mean, every year it seems like there's something I see on a menu that I hadn't seen 10 times in the previous 10 years. And it's like, I can't go through Los Angeles as just a casual eater now without seeing them. Like, what else is having a moment right now?
Oh, man. Cauliflower's having a moment. Everybody loves. That's like the, you know, the new vegetarian meat. Chicories, like radicchios and bitter greens. Mm-hmm. People used to like turn their nose up at and be like, oh, they're awful. They're bitter. Nobody wants to eat these. Now that's like you'll often find that's the only salad on a menu. And it's like people are, once you treat them properly. It's,
if you char really, them, they're delicious.
They're delicious. They're so good with just like a squeeze of lemon. Like, I love it. So, I mean, they're like, you know. It's cool to see what the next is new and like what people are getting into. But I mean, it's to me, I just love that people are getting into the like vegetables and then like elevating the humble vegetable, like the radish or the carrot. You know, it's something that people easily just overlook when they're shopping in the grocery store. But now it's like you can create entire dishes just based around that one vegetable. It's like one of my favorite ways of cooking.
Do you see a real discernible difference between like San Francisco food scene and Los Angeles food scene? I feel like for years much was made of it. San Francisco sort of was the darling and, you know, the Michelin people would ignore Los Angeles and not even regard it as a culinary city, a backwater. I mean, I never put much stock in it. And I think these days it's – but I'm just curious, like, as a chef, is there anything – are there discernible differences between these two cities' food scenes or any two cities' food scenes for that matter?
Here's how I see it. I mean, even I would say what five or eight years ago, when I'd been like, you know, really cooking in San Francisco, is the kind of thing where I was so anti LA. I had been down there a handful of times and just I didn't like the restaurants down there. I didn't think there was like any good food going on. I couldn't stand the traffic, probably most importantly. And it was just always the kind of person that was like, oh, I hate LA, NorCal for life kind of thing. And then slowly over time, I mean, even in the past 5 years, it's taken a complete turn 180, where LA has turned into one of those cities that is people are looking for chef-driven restaurants now. People are respecting food and the ingredient, really like not okay with just Cheesecake Factory and P.F. Chang's. They want all the new and creative and innovative food. And the thing about LA is that it's so big. There's so many untapped pockets and so many pockets of great food and different things that you could find. And San Francisco, on the other hand, now has become the city that is not very big. So all these restaurants are constantly opening, but they're each have their moment for, you know, a week. And if they don't do something incredible or amazing in that 1 week, then a new restaurant opens and nobody remembers them. Everybody moves on and they're always looking for the next and the new. So all of that and coming down to LA and seeing all the, you know, I could still get all the wonderful produce and everything that I found in the Bay Area had really opened my eyes and shifted on where I wanted to be cooking and, you know, continuing my career.
Joe, I wanted to ask you, I asked you in person, but we got to just reiterate the basketball thing. So that wasn't a lie. That wasn't you playing it up. You legit are grossed out by basketball or any sport that requires a passing of balls because it's just gross. So are you a germaphobe or is this just you had a bad experience as a kid? Or you had a traumatic basketball, germy basketball as a kid? Where does that come from?
Well, you know, I would definitely say sports in general as a kid were pretty traumatic, I think, for me. Growing up, I was definitely like that overweight, like token fat kid in the group that were friends with all the athletes and all the like varsity players all through like high school and middle school, but would never get to play on the teams. I would sometimes get picked and sometimes not get picked, and many, many hours and after school time was spent just watching sports with them and pretending that I was interested, when in reality I couldn't stand it, didn't want to watch it, had no interest in it whatsoever. And then the whole thing with the germs and the basketball is not necessarily the germs. It's just I hate the feeling your hands get after you touch a basketball. Even if it's just like one dribble, it feels filthy. Like you don't want, like, you're just like, ugh. Get away from me. I need to go wash the hands now.
I feel like your
I have
pain.
No problem riding the New York City subway, but touching a basketball seems way worse.
I will bring no basketballs when I come to Calmare. one last question about Calmare. You know, it's you guys are doing great. You know, the Beverly Center has always been a little bit of a Bermuda Triangle, I think, for restaurants. Like I think it's a really I would call it a gamble, but it's definitely, I think there's an element of risk into saying, hey, we're going to do this really refined cooking in the Beverly Center, which for those listeners who don't live in Los Angeles, like, it's kind of the big mall. Like, it's the mall in Clueless where Alicia Silverstone is hanging out with her friends, right? Like, that is, like, it's the Beverly Center. And it's a place I think historically probably had, like, an Orange Julius or something. Like, I mean, it's a mall. But you guys are bringing like this, I mean, this really, you know, kind of elevated, refined cooking to a place that normally is sort of a graveyard for it. I mean, how's that going?
Well, first of all, I walked there and walked around in circles for about 20 minutes trying to find the damn restaurant. So, yes, there is a little bit of a mall feel to that where I didn't know where I was going.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've definitely hit all those struggles. Like, I think you put it perfectly. It's, you know, the Beverly Center, everybody is historically viewed as the mall with mall food. And myself, not being an LA native and knowing nothing really about LA, when moving there, I didn't realize that the Beverly Center had that connotation. So I came into it with a completely clean slate about things. And what I really like about what we've done with the restaurant is that it's not necessarily in the mall. It's below the Beverly Center. On the ground floor right there. So we have a separate entrance from the street, a separate entrance for valet, and you could get to it without actually having to walk through the mall like you're walking to a restaurant in the mall, which kind of helps our cause for that matter. And just, you know, it's the kind of thing where people are like, oh, I don't want to go to the Beverly Center. Well, you don't really have to. You could go to the restaurant and completely avoid the Beverly Center altogether. But at the moment, we're the first restaurant that's opened up. There's still tons of construction going on right now. We're just making it, I would say, incredibly difficult to find, like you said, just between closed sidewalks and closed escalators. But you know what they're doing and is pretty incredible is that the Beverly Center is looking to change that whole identity that they have as a mall and really bringing in all these chef-driven restaurants, bringing in all these really interesting concepts, doing all kind of one standalone places that will all be opened up within the next year. And the idea is that we're all going to create synergy off of each other, and people will be wanting to come to the mall as a dining destination and not necessarily just because it's the mall or the Beverly Center. Right.
Last question from me, because I never get a really good chef on the phone without asking for a hint. So inspired by Adrian, I am going to try to, I have a steam oven. This was a local chef when I renovated my kitchen, inspired me to get a steam oven that I can do a lot of cool things. And as much as I like fish, which is like a big thing for me.
Like a house, like an electronic, like steamer oven,
like a combination, like a Bosch combination oven that like I put in the little pitcher of water in the chamber and it creates the steam. And I've done already like beautiful things with it. Like, in terms of you know, chicken and fish, I made a beautiful kind of a muk, like a Cambodian style, like halibut with wrapped in a banana leaf. And it's like I've been able to use steam in a way that I wouldn't otherwise as an idiot home chef. And so this is the, one of the coolest thing in my life is that I own a steam oven. So tonight I want to
no idea they make it for the home cook.
Yeah, no, they do. Pretty cool. They're suckers like me who will buy this stuff now for their homes with the ambition of being a passable chef or home cook, really. So if I'm butter poaching tonight in that steam oven, I'm going to go to my favorite seafood place in Glendale and I'm going to buy some halibut and I want to butter poach it and to perfection and get that silkiness that you get when you order like a butter poached piece of seafood or shrimp or fish. What is the trick? What do I need to be mindful of?
Do you, well, I'm assuming you don't, you have not yet upgraded your kitchen to have a cryovac machine to cook sous vide, do you?
Give me some time on the sous vide. Our comment, we have a friend in our basketball writing world who's obsessed with his sous vide and thinks that this is the greatest advent since like food itself. But I'm not there. But this, I think it functions, the steam oven functions as my sous vide, basically.
Yeah, no, it's very similar. For butter poaching, I mean, to be honest, I don't think you would need the steamer. I think your best bet is to get like a wide, maybe like 3-inch, 4-inch pan.
I got one.
Pot.
I got a nice one. A Kafaline, a stainless steel. Yeah.
Yeah. Make like a super flavorful Bermonté. So I take like some cream, a little white wine, like garlic, herbs, like reduce it down by half. So it becomes almost like thick. Then maybe take like 4 pounds of butter, diced up, and slowly whisk it in, emulsify it, and you'll like have this like super thick, luscious like butter sauce. And then just keep that on low temperature to the point where you could like barely keep your finger in it. And then slide your fish right into there and let it hang out for like 5, 8, 10 minutes, depending on how big the pieces are.
All right, this is good. This is not, this I can do. And how do I know if the sauce is too hot or too not hot enough?
If it's too hot, it'll break and then you'll be in trouble and you'll have just wasted like 4 or 5 pounds of butter.
Oh my God.
So that's the key, is to not to get it too hot. But just, God, I would say not simmering at all. Probably around like 180 degrees would be the ideal temperature.
Right. So I'm not even getting it to that boiling point.
No, not getting it to the boil. Like you could bring the liquid before you start adding to the butter to like a simmer and then lower the heat and slowly start whisking in your butter little by little. And if you notice it's cooling down, turn your heat up a little more. And then like if it's getting too hot, but that's when you keep adding more cold butter, just whisking it in the whole time.
Oh, nice.
It's easier than you.
Yeah. Listeners, you get Top Chef analysis and you get cooking tips.
All in one.
Yes. Hey, Joe, I feel like we've got to watch a finals game with Joe, Kevin.
A basketball game?
Like, yeah, we got to watch a basketball game with Joe and just record that conversation.
Oh man, that'd be
It would be amazing. Joe, thanks so much for joining us. I had such a great meal. Actually, the pistachio gelato dessert that you prepared is probably my favorite thing of the night. And it was a great capper. So the whole experience at Calamari was amazing. And it's an open kitchen, Kevin. You're going to enjoy that. So you can totally critique Joe from afar and he won't even know. So it was a great meal, great ambiance, and you're going to really like it, Kevin. But we're really liking your run so far on Top Chef and we're rooting for you.
Thank you so much, guys. Fingers crossed. Huh?
Hey, thanks for taking the time and Lake Placid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That was fun. It's a nice little break of my day. Never gotten to do a podcast before, so that was
a sports a podcast hosted by sports reporters. How about that?
Yeah, the first time for everything. Probably my first and last podcast I'll end up doing with sports, unless I talk to you guys again.
Yes, we're going to definitely have you on again, for sure.
See you in a couple weeks, Joe.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Joe.
This is Pack Your Knives.